If you love the Fretboard Journal podcast, if you love the other podcasts we put out, like The Truth About Vintage Amps with Skip Simmons, and you want to support what we are all about, we encourage you to subscribe to the Fretboard Journal magazine itself. It comes out 4 times a year. Every issue is 128 pages of incredible guitar storytelling, instrument photography, oral histories, and more. And it is like no other guitar magazine you will ever find. We cover all genres. We try to be as diverse and eclectic as possible. We feature a lot of women in the magazine. And we also go deep with some of the greatest guitar makers and instrument makers alive today. Our next issue is Fretboard Journal number 44. It's going to be mailing out in just a couple of weeks. And if you subscribe now, you will get that delivered to your door in our protective cardboard mailer. You can go to fretboardjournal.com to subscribe. And if you do so, use the coupon code PODCAST. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I am Jason Berlindy, editor of the Fretboard Journal magazine. And as always, that is John Rauhouse playing in the background. Last week, we talked to a recurring guest in the form of Mark Stutman, vintage guitar expert. This week, we have a recurring guest again, Sam Amidon. I believe the first time I talked to him on this podcast, it was a kind of a crappy Skype phone call and a little rushed. This time around, he came by the Fretboard Journal here in Seattle. We had a great sit-down talk, which you are about to hear. He also played a song or two for us, which will be appearing on fretboardjournal.com this week. It is Sam Amidon alongside Sam Gendel. Sam Gendel, amazing horn player, plays through an entire pedal board of effects. I don't know how to describe it. He also played with Rykooter, I think, on the most recent Rykooter tour. These two guys were incredible. So check that out over at fretboardjournal.com. Sam Amidon making insanely great music. You may remember him from the album he did with Bill Frisell playing guitar, Lily O, or maybe from his most recent record, The Following Mountain. But go check out his music wherever you check out music, because it is like nothing else, and we are big fans around here. What else to report? Fretboard Journal 44, off to press. That's going to be mailing to all of our subscribers shortly. So if you haven't subscribed yet, hurry up. Now is the time. It is the best way to support what we are about. Believe it or not, we are a tiny operation. So by subscribing to the print magazine, you are helping power this podcast, the videos, the documentaries we do, and everything else. So please join us. We are a reader-supported magazine. The media landscape is a little bleak sometimes. I'm not expecting all the newsstands that are up and running today to be around in 5 or 10 years. And by subscribing, we can work directly with you. The money goes straight into the Fretboard Journal account with no distributors or anything taking their cut. And it's a great way to show your support for independent magazines such as ours. All right, nothing else to report. We have a slew of great videos on fretboardjournal.com besides the Sam Amidon one. So check out Mike Baghetta. Check out all the stuff we have. We've just had a string of great musicians come through here over the last 30 days or so, and we are so excited to share it with you guys. And without further ado, here is my talk with Sam Amidon. We're doing it. We're doing the podcast.
Great meeting you.
Oh, great to meet you.
Thank you, bro. About the bus ride.
How you're on the Greyhound bus tour now.
The Greyhound bus.
That was so chill, man. Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's like, wow. And you've done this before?
Not for many years. Okay. I did one about 10 years ago, one of my first tours. I did a train and bus tour, totally solo. It was fun. It was very tiring after a while.
And
Europe, I do it all the time, obviously. But
sure. And you're still, are you still based in London?
I still live in London, yes.
How's that? How's the family?
It's all good. It's all good. I play basketball every Monday night, and I go walk in the park, and it works out.
And are you?
I'm like, good at basketball in England.
I was going to say, are you like advanced?
Yes,
because
I'm a center.
All right.
Yeah, I'm good at basketball.
So anyone struggling in local playgrounds in the States, just find a different country.
Come to England.
Okay.
No, I'm not one of the best players. Even there, I'm not one of the best, but I can play.
That's awesome. And you're touring through the States right now on Greyhound buses.
Yes.
Do you have a new release out right now?
No, I'm playing just shows in my life, but if it's in the context of anything, it would be The Following Mountain, which is the album I made a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
I should probably start thinking about something else.
I was going to say,
I'm working on a project though right now, which is I'm doing some concerts in Belgium at the Ancien Belgique. They've commissioned me to do a concert, a new concert program that's a tribute to Harry Smith and the Anthology of American Folk Music.
Okay.
So I'm excited about that, and I'm kind of putting that. So that's a little bit. That's something I'm working on at the moment.
Tackling how that even shapes into something.
Yeah, I mean, because obviously people, that has been mined so in so many different ways over the years, and of course I'm going to do folk songs from the collection. That'll be fun. And there's many on there that I don't really know that well. I mean, I know the anthology the way that everybody knows it, but to be honest, I don't. There's a lot of it that I haven't delved too deeply into.
Okay.
So that'll be fun to really do it. But I'm also just going to be kind of inspired by like Harry Smith himself and who he was, what and his wild character he was, because I've heard various stories over the years from people who knew him. So I'm not quite sure how those stories are going to emerge in the show yet, but I'm going to make sure that
they
do.
That's pretty exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Every time I've seen you play guitar, including today, you have the exact same Martin, it looks like.
Yes.
What is the story behind that?
I found it in my wife's attic.
Okay.
And so she must have gotten it along the way somewhere. And I don't know anything about instruments or guitar. It's an OM-15.
Yeah.
I don't think it had been played very much when I first pulled it out of the case. Like I didn't think it was that good because it just didn't feel that good to play. But I just started. I mean, I liked it, but it wasn't my. But then over a couple of years, it just really warmed up, and I just loved the sound of it. And in fact, I didn't have it for a couple of days recently, and I definitely was. I was playing a different guitar, and I was missing it. So I've gotten used to it. But I did pretty much just nick it from my wife.
Okay. And you said you're not really into gear geekery, but with the fiddle, are you?
No, I mean, I was. You know, it's funny. I had this conversation with Sam, who was playing saxophone. I realized that all my instruments I've appeared along the way in one way or another.
Okay.
And I'm not a geek about the fiddle in the sense I don't know about fiddles, but that particular fiddle is very meaningful to me, extremely. It's the only violin I've played since I was 17, and it was made for me.
Okay.
By Bob Childs, who is a really wonderful violin maker in Boston.
Okay.
And he is. He makes violins, and they're used by all different, you know, symphony, classical musicians, but he himself is a fiddle player. And so a lot of traditional fiddlers in the world that I grew up in mm-hmm. had his instruments. And, okay. There's an ensemble of people called Child's Play who play his violins and everything that I've been part of. But, so that violin was made by Bob Childs, and it was made for me by him when I was 18, and I was able to actually go to his workshop and choose the wood, and we tapped the wood. You could sort of hear things for, you know, a warmer tone or a brighter tone. And again, it's something that this has just, you know, worn in over the years.
Sure.
It's just my, you know, deep, deep connection to that instrument.
Very cool. And the banjo, another hand-me-down?
The banjo was my high school graduation present
okay.
from my mom. And we bought it at Maple Leaf Music, which is a quite a legendary instrument store in Brattleboro that I think it's still going in some form, but I think they got priced out, unfortunately, of there. But they were, for like 30 years, they were a classic instrument store in Brattleboro, Vermont, that people, traveling musicians, knew about. And it's a Bart Ryder, he's a living banjo maker.
Yeah.
And again, it's funny, like, because I'm not that kind of person, it's very accidental what instruments I've gotten to, but then they end up dictating things like when I got that banjo, I liked the banjo, but I really wished I had I was really into more of the gut string banjo and the kind of African, the more banjos that were like fretless or that had that richer, rawer, like the deeper tone. And in a way I was like, the Bart Ryder was too bright for what I imagined in terms of what mm-hmm. I was excited about for old time music. But actually in my life, it's really worked because, it has such a melodic tone and it's been more versatile in terms of the kinds of music I've ended up playing in my life, which is beyond just playing old time music. And,
sure.
you know, and it's actually, so, and even there, like, it's, I've really come to it, to that instrument in a way.
Yeah.
Well, I still want to get a clawhammer. I mean, a fretless banjo, though.
I think you could. The money you save by taking the bus.
Yes, exactly. Three more Greyhound bus tours. That's a fretless banjo.
So there's so much going on when you're playing. I mean, we just saw you with the saxophone going through all sorts of effects, and you had some crazy vocal fiddle thing going on. try to describe for folks what exactly, how you're approaching this, what vocal styles you're using. Is it an amalgam of a bunch of different ones?
Well, I think that a lot of what I do definitely emerges from traditional folk music. Yeah. Even the more experimental sides of what we're doing are still, for me, emerging from corners of that music that I'm inspired by. And I really love, and I've talked about this a lot, like, you know, experimental music and free jazz. And that was a big, as a teenager, I discovered that music and it was very important for me. But in a way, what it did was it helped me hear the field recordings and Appalachian mountain music and that, the different folk music things, in a new way. And so singing, as I mentioned to you before we started recording, we started the song Another Story Told, and I looked over it. I was very kept on getting distracted by all these wonderful CDs you have.
They're a little archaic, but we like them. They're quaint.
And it's a great technology. And I just happened, my eyes happened to go to your collection of Sacred Harp CDs.
Yeah.
And it's fun. And actually there's I drop a bit of a Shape Note song called Parting Friends in the middle of that, Another Story Told song. And Shape Note / Sacred Harp music is a folk choral tradition that started in New England in the late 1700s and moved west and south and survives in the south as a sort of Baptist tradition there, but it's now spread like around the world and as just a musical. But it's always it's spiritual, it's religious, it's hymns, but it's always been a social tradition. It's never been done in church. It's always a social. So it's kind of exists in an interesting space.
Yeah,
and it's basically folk choral music. It's like choral, you know, choral singing in four parts, but the people are really singing in a full, loud, you know, reedy tenor kind of, you know, full chest voice. And so I grew up with a lot of that music and I loved singing it. And I think so a lot of some of my vocal stuff comes really from the Shape Note, even though I sing much more quietly than I would if I was at a Sacred Harp sing. You really sing loud at those. And when I sing on stage, I sing very quietly, but I'm still using some of that stuff in there.
And where was your family in the Shape Note universe in Vermont? Were their parents doing it and their grandparents, or they kind of drunk?
They discovered it as hippie 20 somethings in Cambridge in the folk scene in the 1970s.
Okay.
And they were young people, in Cambridge, in New England, discovering folk music. And, you know, there's a funny thing, like each generation has its version of the folk revival.
Sure.
And there's, if you think about like the 1930s and 40s and with the kind of workers music. And then in the 60s, it's like the, you know, Dylan and the guitar and singing around a campfire and the protest thing as well. And then in the 70s, I think, or at least whatever, in New England, and when my parents' version of it, that the world they were part of, was really less about that. It was less about guitar and singing and song circle, and it was more about all the different community kinds of folk music making, like fiddle tunes, Irish fiddle tunes, folk contra dancing and square dancing, English country dancing, group harmony singing. So it was all the different corners of it that are like really about collective. It was really much more about collective music making than about one person singing in front of an audience.
Yeah.
And so I barely knew who Bob Dylan was growing up. I never heard Joni Mitchell till I was like 20. You know, it was a totally different version of the folk revival than, I mean, they loved all that stuff in their own youths, but that was not what we were, you know, checking out. It was really more about fiddle players, Irish fiddle players, traditional folk singers. They wouldn't have been listening to field recordings. Like it was all, you know, they knew all that stuff again from their youths but really for them, once you learned a song, you would just sing it with your friends.
Wow.
You know? And so it wasn't about, fetishizing the scratchy recordings at all. And in fact, I remember when I told my mom as a teenager, cause the Harry Smith anthology was reissued for the first time on CD when I was a teenager. That was when a lot of stuff, attention came to it at that time. And I remember, it's like, I'm going to order this. And she's like, you know, those recordings are kind of scratchy, right? Like she kind of almost warned me, like, are you sure you're going to like that? It's like really kind of, and even though she loves those musicians, but she'd like seen Almeda Riddle singing at folk festivals and learned songs from her. And, you know, so then it was really more for them about just, you know, social. It's a social act.
It's a Tupperware party.
Yeah, exactly. 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 It's a it's something you do in people, you're at each other's houses and you're always learning something. It's, you know, there's aspects of it that they had total expertise over, like playing banjo and singing songs. But even now they go to a tune class to learn fiddle tunes from friends of ours, even though they're complete master musicians in other ways, you know?
Yeah.
So that's what's cool about it. It was just that world of just really the music being quite alive. And so many people were like my parents and grew up in New England or moved to New England and had kids there, which meant that me and my friends were lucky enough to grow up in this world where, you know, we were going to folk dances and we were having sacred harp sings at our house and we were, but it wasn't like, there was nothing about it like that was vintage or anything, you know, it was just in your, was just, it was our daily, it was just like part of our world. And it wasn't, you know, a rejection of anything in terms of modern culture or anything. It was just what they, you know, a way for them to have a community.
So then finding the sort of avant-garde scene of jazz, like, was that scary at first, or was that just sort of,
it was just weird. It was just alien and strange and beautiful. I was lucky that there was a good CD store in Brattleboro and I would just go buy what, you know, you're just curious and you check things out. And there were people from that world in the woodwork around Southern Vermont. There was a guy named David Moss who had worked with John Zorn and Frizzell and people like that in the really late 70s, early 80s. He was living in Vermont and I got to go see him play when I was a little kid with some incredible musicians of that world.
Yeah.
And there was a guy named Rafe Malik, a trumpet player who'd played with Cecil Taylor. He lived in the area and was, and so there were people there even in Vermont connected, and Amherst wasn't far away, which had a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
So no, it was just exciting and strange and wonderful.
That's awesome. When you're doing your more experimental stuff, in a live setting, I'm curious, I've seen a bunch of avant-garde and free jazz shows and 75% of them transport the listener and take you to places. And then 25%, you're just like, I think they went too far. Is it, do you ever feel like you go too far? Are there moments?
I have no idea. Oh, no. I feel that I like the ones where they go too far at those shows. No, I know what you're saying. I have no idea. No, you go. I mean, being performing in front of an audience is a very strange activity to begin with.
Yeah.
Like to go stand in front of people for a prescribed amount of time. And it's very odd.
Is it natural? I mean, is it easy for you? Do you have to psych yourself up to get in a state of mind, or?
It's fairly, I started at quite a young age being on front of performing and so in that way it's not, but it is an inherently odd thing to do. And sometimes you're on stage and it occurs to you how odd it is.
Is there, do you have a preference of like, I don't want to see the audience or?
No, not really. I mean, I think that, I don't know. I think that you have a sense of things feel different every night, you know, and you don't really know how things are going over all the time. So you just trust that it's all going to work out.
Yeah.
And people are very open-minded as audiences in general, I find. And there's no rule about where they're more or less, you know, which people in the audience are, you know, there's like, I have no stereotype around a crowd, an audience or a crowd. Yeah. And you literally never know. And I used to bring friends, like when I was young in college, I used to bring friends up to Vermont to play, my friends in Brooklyn who are more like free improv musicians.
Yeah.
And I'd bring them up and just set them up a show in Brattleboro for my parents' friends. And people are always interested in checking stuff out.
Yeah. Very cool. Well, I know you got to go sound check and catch your next bus.
Yeah, that's right. So it's a bolt bus tomorrow.
I'm impressed. I'm impressed you're doing it. Thank you so much for coming by, Sam.
Thank you.
The songs you played were great.
Thank you so much.